Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, you're welcome back. So we're reviewing the Sunday Papers. We'll start with your headlines. We're streaming on Facebook as well if you want to tune in and watch there. But if you're happy with the radio, then don't go anywhere. Stockdale lets it slip. That is the front page of the Sunday Times sports section. Leinster joined Munster in Euro semi-finals after Ireland star blows try and Ulster's hopes. I would suspect he's having a fairly tricky morning this morning, Jacob Stockdale. And the picture actually is not of him butchering that try chance. It's failing to catch Adam Byrne, who went over for that crucial Leinster try. Ulster feel the burn is the back page of the Mail on Sunday. This is Adam Byrne. Adam and Ross scored the crucial points as Leinster make last four in Europe. 21 points to 18 if you didn't catch the scoreline. Back page of the Sun, La Haya. PSG ready to offer United ace $350,000 per week. They are De Gea's wage demands. PSG are certainly happy to pay that. And no can do for Tribe. Galway have to reach the latter stages of the All-Ireland Championship without Joe Canning. He's been ruled out for 16 weeks. He's going to have groin surgery. Is the front page there of the Sun. The Sunday Independent then, going with the rugby as well for their main picture. Adam Byrne, very happy after scoring his try. Back from the brink is the headline. Leinster and Munster forced to battle to keep their cup dreams alive. And then below here, Donegal recover to overhaul Meath, yesterday's league final. Back page of the Sunday Mirror, Real Steel. This is Real Madrid. Boss Zidane wants Pogba. And it seems, based on comments during the week, that Pogba wants Real Madrid. So that's a worrying development for Paul Pogba fans at Manchester United. And then the Sunday World, finally, Klopp's mojo is back. Klopp believes Salah can drive pool to glory. He hasn't scored in 10 games, which is his longest drought for Salah at Liverpool, but they have Spurs today. It's live here on Off the Ball. We're joined in studio by Declan Lynch from the Sunday Independent and Sinead O'Carroll from The Journal. You're both very welcome. Thanks for popping in. It's Paul Pogba's dream to play for Real Madrid, I'm seeing on the back pages.
It is, nicely lined up quotes from the two of them, aren't they?
Yeah.
It is his dream, and then Zidane says, you know, it shouldn't be about just Zidane, it should be about Madrid as well. And if his stint is at United comes to an end, it would be a great place for him. So not orchestrated, I wouldn't think at all. No. I love when footballers go, so he was obviously, Pogba was with the French camp this week. I love when they think that their quotes won't like get back to the country that they live in.
We're in France. This won't make it back home, right?
Like, I can totally say this, right? Like, it would be my absolute dream to play with the biggest club, Real Madrid.
Not an international.
Not that other tiny club that I play with every week in, week out.
Not an international window goes by without a South American player lambasting his manager on South American radio somewhere.
Just United in general, like, I mean, we thought that everything was great now that Ole Gunnar Solskjaer is there, but there's old Pogba. We thought he was going to be there for the rest of his life, and everybody's happy. But I was watching them yesterday against Watford, and it was, again, one of these weird things when you've spent so many years watching a certain Manchester United and having this view of them, and then you look at them sort of, and phrases are coming into your head like, they're fighting a heroic rearguard action against Watford at home. And this has become normal. You know, like the normalization of things that we speak about in other areas.
Yeah.
You know, that things, you know, every, like, Trump does something everywhere. And imagine if in normal times, but normal times don't exist anymore. So now we live in this world where Manchester United celebrate wildly after a late winner against Bournemouth. Mm. And we accept this. And there was a time we would have regarded this as simply surrealism, right? I didn't see that headline about De Gea, the great David De Gea, the man who has tormented me more than any other. Like, this is a terrible joke that is played on all of us that, you know, who are not Manchester United fans, that one day David De Gea will be sold to somebody else, right? I have lived in hope for years, right? The vain hope that Real Madrid for years were going to sign him. And now PSG have come in with another fake bid of $350,000 a week. You know, it is sent to torment us, you know.
He will leave when he's about 40.
Yeah, and the one sure thing in the world is that he will be there forever.
David Walsh has a nice piece on Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and he takes the, because actually I was saying this morning that I think the appointment is a bit of a win-win for Solskjaer himself, because, like, he's done it now. Like, he's proven that he can do the job. Like, he's had the best start of any Premier League manager ever. If things go wrong, he can say he wasn't supported, Pogba left, it wasn't the team that he took on, you know, if things go dreadful next year. But Dave Walsh is on the other side, says it's actually a win-win for Woodward, because, you know, he had to give him the job because he was almost too good as the caretaker manager. Mm. So if it goes south, there was no other decision he could have made.
Yeah, so it's a fairly common opinion out there. I think what makes Walsh's piece pretty interesting is the route he gets to. So he basically, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer here is the Rock of Gibraltar. That's the way.
The horse.
Yeah, the horse.
Not the actual rock.
Not the island, not the rock. The Ferguson, John Magner thing, this is what Walsh kind of brings up as a way of getting to his point about Solskjaer. His argument is maybe Solskjaer was too good, deceptively good as a caretaker manager, and now the reality is going to set in and nobody could, you know, nobody foresaw how good he would be. And John Magner, I didn't realise why he had given Alex Ferguson a 50% share in the Rock of Gibraltar.
That story was new to me as well.
Yeah.
So the fact that he had wanted Alex Ferguson to make a speech.
Yeah.
And the powers that be in the horse racing world didn't think that this was befitting of tradition. And Magner didn't like that he was slighted that day.
Basically, Magner had a horse called Mull of Kintyre who won the Gimcrack Stakes of York. And the tradition is that you give the winning speech. Mm-hmm. Magner doesn't court publicity in that way, so he wanted Ferguson to give the speech. But Racing's Blue Blood said Walsh didn't want to break with tradition. Magner was not impressed. So 2 years later, he had what Walsh calls a nice horse, and it was at that stage. Rock of Gibraltar had shown a bit of promise. So ahead of the Gimcrack Stakes, which he was running the horse in again, he offered Ferguson 50% of the colt. No training fees, vet fees, travel costs, just take 50%. Rock of Gibraltar wins the Gimcrack Stakes. Ferguson gets to make the speech. Everybody's happy, except, as Walsh says, it turns out then Rock of Gibraltar was not just a horse. He was a freak. He won 7 Group 1 races, by a distance the best European miler of his generation. And nobody had anticipated that there would be a stud career, because he came from Offshore Boom, who was a very ordinary breeder, the mother of Offshore Boom, and then the career at stud unexpectedly beckoned. And at that point, the word from Coolmore was, you get 50% of the horse, you don't get any of the stud fees.
Yeah, everything else that comes after the horse is not yours.
Yeah. I didn't realise it was over just wanting Ferguson to make a speech on his behalf at the Gimcrack Stakes.
Yeah, the Gimcrack.
Gimcrack.
Gimcrack Stakes.
Sorry, that shows how unaware I am.
Well, racing people who call it Gimcrack, it's probably correct. Gimcrack may be the correct pronunciation of the word. But
and is this a big race? I should have known this.
It's one of those legendary old races in the, God knows what it's called now, maybe sort of, you know, the Boyle Sports Eat While You Go handicap or something. But it's one of the great old sort of names of British racing, the Gimcrack Stakes, you know.
Yeah.
But
Walsh says, by the way, so Ferguson then, not a man, he says, adept, and a man adept at standing up for himself. He was never going to accept this, and so began the battle. And in the end, Ferguson was given a reported 2.5 million as a sort of compensation.
Because he didn't kind of continue on with the fight.
It was fascinating as well, because for Ferguson, this potentate, you know, a man who ruled everything he surveyed, and perhaps still does at Manchester United, and being sort of bested by bigger
fish,
potentates. Yeah. You know, it was really interesting in that sense, like psychologically, like for him, it must have been really difficult, like to actually find himself in, you know, everything had started so well, and he was basically in a situation where he was suddenly the little guy.
Yeah, very much so.
And the reason David Walsh kind of compares the two is, but the headline he remembers from that whole affair was the horse that was too good, and so that's what made him think of Solskjaer, that this is he has been too good for the last few months.
Yeah,
it is also so interesting. Like the people just move on from these things, but there's this increasing thing of like the United players under Mourinho, right? Like, were they simply shackled and you know, kept in sort of prison conditions or something, right? Or how much of it was them? I mean, the idea that sort of now they're all happy, play football.
Shackles right? are off, I think.
But
is the
I'm thinking of the poor divils who were going along to Old Trafford from, you know, places as far as Madagascar, perhaps every week. You know what I mean? A lifetime trip to Old Trafford, who inadvertently found themselves just observers of this little game that was going on between Mourinho and the lads. You know, like this has happened on several occasions in recent seasons. Chelsea took a year off, right? City kind of took a year off. Mm. And you think of, you know, these people who live for this stuff, you know, the fans, you know, those people, and just how apparently indifferent.
It's the rights responsibility are, thing, though, isn't it? And that comes back to, like, who gets the most praise when a team wins the Premier League? It is the manager.
Yeah.
So I think if you're taking on that right to get that praise, then you take on the responsibility. And I think every time I came in here, Mourinho had said something horrendous that I could not imagine being in a dressing room with him. And I just think, like, even though players do have the responsibility to turn up and, you know, to play for the fans and to play for the team that pays them every week, he must have been doing something particularly horrendous, like you were saying, keeping them in conditions akin to mental health prison.
Yeah, but it's fascinating when you watch it on Sky or how quickly everyone wants to move. No one really wants to talk about that. You know what I mean? The thing of, like, you know, in horse racing, there's a non-triers rule. Do you know what I mean? Like, there's the stewards are on top of things. Horse racing, which has a very dodgy reputation, you know, throughout history. And yet, even horse racing, you know, they've quite sort of strict things about, like, non-trying.
Paul Pogba couldn't try because he wasn't on the pitch most of the time.
But he didn't even try to look sort of happy on the bench. Or he didn't, his bench game wasn't even all that good, you know. It's just interesting, and no one knows the answer, simply because these things are just kept from us as well, you know, and we're just fed nonsense most of the time.
But this is true. At best, you might find out in an autobiography in about 10 years' time.
Yeah, and then in a deeply dubious way. So,
it is the horrible truth, I think, for a lot of fans who invest so much and care so much, and then Eden Hazard's just not bothered.
Yeah, it's not.
Oh, look, it's just soul destroying, you know. And you know, okay, Ole Gunnar seems like a good lad, you know, and he comes in
and a great lad.
He's a great lad.
He's a great lad.
Amazing club.
Yeah, you know, he's you know, but the whole idea of the fact that players are happier under, you know, when he's around, it's like he's one of them or something. I don't think that well, I don't think players are supposed to be happy.
But we have built this system where players are kept in this childlike status for a long time. Like, that's the Premier League structure that has been built, that they're minded, taken care of. You know, they don't, you know, there was a book, the Transfer Market book that was released at the start of this year, talking about players who didn't know how to hoover, didn't know how to turn on washing machines, didn't know the difference between washing machines and dishwashers. You know, we have created this structure where players do need to be minded from, like, those small practical things right up to how the manager talks to them and talks about them on air. And I think it was it looked and sounded like a toxic place to be.
No, it did,
Mourinho.
For sure. Do you know what's very interesting? We'll get on to Mick McCarthy later on. Obviously, there's pieces about the Ireland performance during the week, but it was really noticeable. A lot of the former players who are now pundits were talking about Mick McCarthy when he got the Ireland job, the likes of Kevin Kilbane or Gary Breen or all that generation. And it was amazing talking to them at different times. They all, independently of each other, said things like, well, the great thing about Mick is you just know where you stand with him. As in, if he tells you this is why you're not in the team, or this is why you're in the team, or this is what you're doing well, you can actually take that as the truth. Mm. And the inference was, you literally just can't trust any manager that you have in your career. Like, they're all just duplicitous. They're telling you one thing to your face. They're saying you're great, and then they're going off someone else saying we have to get rid of that guy. Mm. And just a basic kind of honesty and decency does not seem to be the norm in this really dirty world, where managers, you know, getting paid a few million a year, they get fired, it's not the end of the world. They're not thinking long term. It just seems like a terrible environment. We'll have to see if Ole Gunnar Solskjaer gets sucked into
it. And I suppose it shows that when you have the odd very good manager comes in, like, they tend to be there for a long time, simply because it's quite rare.
It is.
Maybe it's like in anything. Do you know what I mean? You know, in any sort of field, maybe there are there's only a few people who are just really, really good. Like,
human beings, most of us are just a bit rubbish. Truth, you know? So That's Pogba on the back pages. So look, it does seem like Real Madrid's really on, because Zidane is saying, I know him personally, I like him. And Pogba was saying over international duty, it's my dream to play for Real Madrid one day. So that seems legit.
And there's also Zidane as a coach, and it's a dream for anybody who likes football. Like, it's actually kind of hilarious, the quotes.
Yeah, Zidane's there's a tone in what Zidane says, is like, you know, we just have to sort out the paperwork, you know.
It seemed like that, all of a sudden out of nowhere, yeah. So the rugby was in all the front pages, anything grabbing your eyes?
Yeah, it's interesting actually when you're talking about, you know, the managers. I think there was a lot spoken of with Carberry and Van Gran and how kind of that personal coaching touch and makes such a difference, and Dan McFarland last night just refusing to be drawn on Jacob Stockdale. And it, like, Stockdale, actually the first person I thought of when I woke up this morning was Dan Levy, because I'm so devastated for him, and actually devastated for Ireland as well, because I think there was a lot of talk at around November that actually he mightn't even be starting in the Six Nations and the World Cup if everybody else got fit. I think the Six Nations put paid to that. I think he absolutely would have been starting in the World Cup, and it looks like that's probably beyond him now if the leg break reports are true. But the second person in my mind was Jacob Stockdale. How do you wake up this morning and not only do you know you have messed up that no try, but also people like Neil Francis are talking about your four missed tackles. Shane Horgan is saying it wasn't just the try, it was...
Yeah, so Shane Horgan says, I don't want to kick a man when he's down.
But I'm going to.
And you can bet the Ulstering probably never felt as low in his career as he did last night. But Stockdale made defensive errors which were just as costly as his failure to touch the ball down properly.
I think it was really telling, and I think I tweeted last night, Jacob Stockdale should get on the phone to Keith Earls immediately. Jacob, obviously, 6'3", 6'4". He barely bends down. He tries to use his arm. He's bending from his waist. There's no attempt to get off his feet at all. Keith Earls, when he's going over for his 71st minute try, is practically vertical. He's diving so high. He's coming across. He knows that there's a chance someone can reach him, but if he gets his legs up high enough, they're going to miss the tackle, which happens, and he gets the ball down, no problem. And Jacob Stockdale is, what, a couple of metres over the white line, and he's not even bending. He's dead right straight. Shane Horgan makes the point in the Sunday Times that there's a smile about to creep into his face, much like what happened to the Italian.
Now, I said to him last night, because we were doing the highlights for Virgin, and I said, are you sure it's not a grimace? And he's adamant it's a smile. But I remember Ciarán McGeehan finishing fourth or third. Where did Ciarán McGeehan finish? She got a medal.
Third.
She was just pipped for... silver. And on the TV, they thought maybe she had a bit of a wry smile, but then it was either Gerry Kiernan, who'd know her pretty well, said, no, that's a grimace.
She was not happy with her third.
But somebody thought that was a smile. So I don't know, maybe Stockdale is grimacing trying to get over the line.
Yeah, perhaps. Maybe. He knew he was in trouble at that stage because he hadn't bent early enough. Murray Kinsella spotted that he had spoken to his under-20s coach last year, and said that his under-20s coach said he used to give him heart attacks because he used to be 3 or 4 metres past the whitewash and wouldn't bend, and sometimes would look like he was about to not get the try.
Right.
So this has been an issue for him. It's not a once-off. So
that has to be sorted out.
That really worried me then. If it was a once-off and he actually, because he's a tall guy, he was upright. He obviously, you're a lot faster when you're, you know, back straight. So, and he had got past, what, seven Leinster players. So I was kind of giving him the benefit of the doubt, and then I saw that and I thought, oh man, Jacob, if this has been an issue that someone has flagged with you before, you get off your feet, you dive, and you have two hands on the ball.
Yeah. I don't think he will ever make this mistake again.
I don't watch a lot of rugby, but for some reason, on three occasions, right, I've seen this happen. This people about to score a try and about to celebrate, and like the other week, the Italian guy.
Marco Zanoni.
Yeah. Mm. If ever it was like a once in a lifetime thing.
Now, he was definitely smiling.
He was smiling. Yeah. That was,
and was practically belly laughing. Yeah.
And it seems like such a basic thing. Like
there was Freddie Burns for Bath as well.
Yeah, that was a celebrated one. And I happened to see, I don't know how I saw this.
Is there a Declan Lynch curse here? Is that what this is?
What?
Is there a Declan Lynch curse?
It must be. But I'm looking at this article in the Observer by Paul Rees about the psychology, about how Eddie Jones, the England manager, is trying to employ the services of a health company called Headspace, which is to do with psychological kind of assistance to sports people, right? But too, because he was kind of taken aback by how England collapsed against Scotland, and he feels that they, for some reason, they don't have a kind of their heads aren't right, you know? And the piece goes on to sort of, there's a kind of a punchline halfway through it when it points out among the other people they've been working with are Arsenal. Right? At that point, you know, canned laughter comes up, you know. And mindfulness, of course, is always there, thereabouts. You'll never get through this without reading, seeing the word mindfulness a few times. But like Sinead was pointing out as well that, like, we thought all this had been achieved already by, you know, even Gaelic football teams have psychological kind of advice or, you know, training or
a lot assistance. Of GAA teams have, like, you know? They have the benefit of them constantly. Like, they're signed up for the year.
Yeah.
But you would think, in terms of rugby, putting the ball down when you cross the line, that would be lesson one, you know, in the, I know like Headspace do offer a wide range of services, but maybe they could begin, they sort of, nothing is too simple, it appears.
Listen, it appears so.
Yeah, I think it is interesting if England don't have a sports psychologist on their books.
I'd be shocked if they don't.
I would be very shocked.
Like, they absolutely must, they do.
That can't be something that has just passed by the English rugby setup.
There's no way Eddie Jones has suddenly thought, psychology seems important. I might look into this. Maybe they're just moving on from somebody else to Headspace.
To this place, yeah.
What's Neil Francis saying about the game?
Neil Francis has some nice one-liners about both games. So with Leinster, he said they look like one of those Kinder eggs with no toys inside last night. So he kind of makes the point of, you know, the two best teams yesterday, the teams who played the best rugby were Edinburgh and Ulster, but ended up, you know, losing out to kind of the greater experience of what he calls typical Munster. So he calls Munster typical Munster throughout his column, which I'd say will annoy a few people further south of us right now. He obviously takes massive issue with Stockdale. Stockdale tells him, you know, two hands good, one hand bad, about the no try, but also takes issue again, very similar to Shane Horgan, about the four missed tackles. His point mostly is that Leinster's stand-ins are just not of semi-final standard. He, you know, even the likes of Adam Byrne, he puts in there who got the try, and with the Munster then obviously just picks out Keith Earls, who he said whose presence of mind was on another level from anyone else on the pitch. This was about his first try, tapped the ball from the mark and was over the line before any of the Edinburgh players could complain. Earls has been electric all season and is sharp to all possibilities that he has become typical Munster's most important player.
Yeah, he's a brilliant story, Keith Earls. Like, 10 years ago now, went on that Lions tour as a young player and had his confidence just smashed to smithereens, didn't go well, and then has talked about just struggling to get preparation right, getting really big at certain points when it was in vogue to get big and then getting too skinny. And it seems like in the last four or five years even, he's just almost found himself professional.
Yeah, he's figured it out.
And it's like he's getting faster.
It is. He's a wonder to watch. And I actually found yesterday, because I watch a lot of rugby, but I don't particularly have, like, I'm from Leinster, so I probably should have, you know, the graw for Leinster, but
are you coming out of the closet as a Leinster fan?
No, I'm actually Ireland first is what I call it. I seem to just gravitate towards players and who I like watching, and I was so confused yesterday. I was like, I don't know what I'm meant to be, like, thinking and feeling here, because I do actually genuinely just watch the Irish players and how they're doing and what, and you do end up, I was sitting there yesterday going, who am I meant to be up for in this match? But I think Keith Earls and Joey Carberry are the two people I just absolutely have adored watching in the last season, really, the last year.
By the way, Shane Horgan on Conor Murray says, Conor Murray's always been a man to trust, yet there's no doubt he hasn't the same since his injury. And he says of the current situation, the tempo is not there. This has also infected his decision making, which up until now has been exemplary. And he says neither Munster nor Leinster's performances will worry Saracens, Racing or Toulouse. They will have two noted giants of the European stage, drawing all their experience to edge out two testy opponents, and they'll know that both Irish sides are capable of better. They'll have to be, because Saris are flying.
Yeah, and Neil Francis agrees. I think both of them are very much on the same page that semi-final might be as good as it gets for the two Ireland provinces.
Especially if Leinster have to go to France.
Yeah.
If Toulouse win today, they'll be at home. Yeah. Leinster, that is. So
I think with the Conor Murray thing, the decision-making, I agree with Shane, and particularly in the France game when everyone felt that it was getting back on track and Ireland were getting to their best. And I really didn't feel that in the Aviva that day at all. I was leaving thinking, you know, that they had to win that match, obviously, because France were so poor. But it didn't feel like that. And Conor Murray's decision-making still felt off. That that quick decision making that he is, that allows him to be as confident as he is, and that confidence allows him then to do the things that he does. Mm. But there was that moment for the second try yesterday where the offload was something a little different. It was a little bit of magic. So at least there was that. At least there's something coming back. And, you know, after an injury like that, a neck injury, it might take some time.
Totally. I saw Luke Fitzgerald tweeting that he thought he was really good yesterday. So there's various opinions out there. We're going to take a very short break. There's loads more to get to in the papers. Obviously, there's FAI coverage, as there has been over the last number of weeks. Seamus Coleman and the Mick McCarthy era generally being discussed, and a few other bits and pieces. Now, you're welcome back. So we're reviewing the Sunday papers. Sinead O'Carroll and Declan Lynch here in studio. They're just underway at Croke Park in the Hurling League final. Limerick 2 points to no score up against Waterford. Galway beat Kilkenny in the Camogie by 2 points. And we'll preview Mayo Kerry with Mike Quirk later on. But we're going to finish off reviewing the Sunday papers. FAI, all over the papers again, as you might imagine. This Oireachtas hearing is on Wednesday, so I suspect there's going to be plenty more FAI coverage across the week.
News and sport.
Yeah, news and sport. So in terms of news front pages, the Sunday Times have a report which, I mean, all may be proper and well, it must be stressed, but it was something I was unaware of, and maybe it will come up at the Oireachtas committee, maybe it won't. So they're just talking about Delaney's, well, they start off by talking about his €300 a day on UEFA Business, which is the per diem that you get, which I suppose is nice if you can get it. But then separately, they say, the Sunday Times has established that the FAI and Delaney have been promoting a deal to football clubs that involves doing business with a company run by Paul Delaney, who is John Delaney's brother. Under the scheme, advertised on the FAI website, clubs can get funding for floodlights and ongoing rental payments from Shared Access, that's the name of the company, American-owned. Paul Delaney, Managing Director of Shared Access since 2017. Before that, he was their Site Solutions Director, and the Sunday Times quote a source in one club saying there were a number of problems with the deal from a club perspective. It increased electricity costs, inflated the price of repairing the floodlights. Neither the FAI nor Shared Access responded to questions last week. Like I said, could all be absolutely proper and fine, but it was just another development, maybe another question mark that people would like clarified.
I think it's another avenue politicians will be questioning on Wednesday if they can. I think the Oireachtas Committee, I think people are a little bit more familiar now with the setup than they were maybe even, and by people I probably mean sports journalists, and I think a lot of sports journalists the last time were expecting something quite different from what they got. I think it was January 2017 when they were last in. And there was a lot of, you know, people standing up and saying, you know, it would be very hard to be critical of the three men in front of them. Mm. It was the IRFU, the GA, and the FAI were all in together, which I think raised some eyebrows. You know, there's maybe not being critical, but there's definitely things that you'd like to ask them questions of in an atmosphere the Oireachtas has, not absolute privilege, but pretty strong privilege in the committee on that day. But they all have to ask a bundle of questions. Yeah. So it's not always the best format to kind of dig and drill into something. So hopefully this time out, if there's enough research and there's enough people working together, that can happen.
Mm. Well, Noel Rock is talking a big game.
He is.
And we'll see what he does. Catherine Murphy was excellent back in January 2017. She was a beacon of hope amidst a fairly grim showing. Yeah. I remember watching it live at the time in January, and we did a piece that night on Off the Ball with one of the politicians, I can't quite remember who it was, almost just to make the point that this was abysmal. Like, you realise this was terrible. John Green has had a look back at that Oireachtas hearing of 2017.
The highlight was, I think it was Peter Fitzpatrick, FG, who part of his questioning was
no longer FG, so just to
I like that he addresses John Delaney. He says, I liked what he said about soccer being focused on social activity as such. Can he elaborate on that? Obesity is a big issue in this country. As the organisation for the biggest sport in Ireland in terms of participation, what is the FAI doing to combat obesity? First of all, if I were John Delaney, I'd welcome that query, because obviously, you know, it's a very important issue. Mm. But I know obesity is a major issue, but the FAI are not the people
to solve it.
Yeah. I think we can, if we have one takeaway from today, it is that obesity will not be solved by the FAI. There are many things they can do, and will do indeed, but that is not one of them.
I think some of the members would do well to look back at when permanent TSB officials were in quite recently, and the same question was asked 9 times before the, an answer was elicited from them about the structure of a setup. They basically wanted to find out if there was a loophole, if any tax would be paid by a new structure that was buying a whole tranche of loans from PTSB. There was no answer to the initial question, the second, the third, the fourth, the fifth, and eventually 9 times they asked the question, they eventually got the answer that there would be no tax paid by that vehicle.
And can I ask, because you have the misfortune of having to sit through a number of Oireachtas committees, I would suspect. A lot of people, for instance, would have seen Michael Cohen being questioned by a select committee in the States recently, and that seems to be a different system whereby each representative gets a certain amount of time with whoever's being questioned. So there is a back and forth. There is question, answer, I'm not happy with your answer, let's dig down more into that. Now, it might only be for 5 or 6 minutes, which isn't overly satisfactory either. But in the Oireachtas committee, certainly that one back in 2017, it seemed like each representative asked 3, 4, 5, 6 different questions and then passed the baton over to their colleague, who asked another list of questions. And on it went, and by the time it came around to John Delaney or Philip Brown answering those questions, you'd forgotten what the first one was. And it was very easy for anybody to just skip answers to questions. Is that the norm? Is that how it works?
That's how it works, yeah. So you get questions, you get a whole load of questions together, and then they come back to the witness.
It's really inefficient.
It's not great. There is a little bit of over and back now, that, and you will see, you'll basically see the politicians who are well-researched and who really care about the particular issue can perform really well in committee. Mm. It's just that Venn diagram, particularly in 2017, of the people who were well-researched and the people who cared, that Venn diagram didn't work out. Catherine Murphy was, I think, the one person who was well-researched, like had questions about corporate governance, knew how long people had been sitting on the FAI board, knew to ask about the 5 million payment after the, you know, suggestion that we'd be the 33rd team.
The House of Commons as well, you look at these committees, and it is really like looking into another world, because, you know, we've seen like appalling clownishness over the last couple of years from, you know, MPs. But these committees, like, they're really good, you know. Like, they bring in someone like Rupert Murdoch and they clean him out. Like, it's extraordinary.
It's a good thumping. The British cycling one was one we followed quite closely here. And they really go to town on people.
Yeah. It's crazy. You're just looking at it and you're thinking, like, how do they do this? Nothing remotely like this happens here.
Doesn't seem to. In the main, are the Oireachtas committees fairly poor?
The PAC, you'll hear a lot about the PAC, and it has a large amount of clout. The problem, I think, that has happened in the last 12 months, and this is an opinion, is that a lot of the time it's the looking for the head on the plate rather than the answers and the probing questions. So you're kind of going at one person rather than trying to figure out how and why something happened. They can be good at probing places to get more information. Say, there's been a lot done in committee about the National Children's Hospital. So they can be good places, but they do have to have that balance of the politicians. I think they also need to work together. The committee members need to work together so that they're not scattergun questions to people. And in this instance, I think there's so much to ask that they have to make sure that they're asking effective questions.
It should be
consistently
a cross-party effort.
It really should be, because this has obviously got to a point where we know that there are a lot of questions. People are interested in the FAI, in what is happening to the structure, the corporate governance, and what will happen in the future, and that it's not just left to kind of govern itself.
There are a number of pieces actually which unfortunately make the mistake of thinking that this Oireachtas committee has been sparked on the back of the Sunday Times €100,000 loan, bridging loan story. November 2018 is when the Oireachtas decided to summon the FAI and, I suppose, John Delaney. And initially it was meant to happen in January of this year. In some respects, I would say the FAI and John Delaney wish that it happened in January of this year, as opposed to after all these stories have broken. So this is not specifically to do with any of these stories. It was more of a general issue. November was when O'Neill and Keane lost their jobs, and there was a lot of talk about the direction of Irish football generally. And the salaries being paid, and that was when the Oireachtas said, let's talk about this.
And people wanted to know what severance payments were involved in that, because obviously they were on huge contracts. They did get sacked, and there was, you know, a need for transparency around what money was going where.
So it's taken on now an added significance almost because these stories are broken. We'll have to see how the Oireachtas Committee performs. It's on Wednesday. I suspect we'll play you back long chunks of it and Off the Ball. I suspect a lot of people will just watch it live on the website.
I think they probably will, yeah, because there are...
Or Oireachtas TV.
Oireachtas TV, yeah, and they can be really entertaining at times as well, and illuminating. There'll be things that they won't be able to hide from. You know, you can tell if someone wants to answer a question or how they're answering a question. So the best way of going about, you know, if you're trying to figure out where you stand on this, I think there's been a lot of talk about, you know, the great grassroots work that's being done. From my point of view, I genuinely want to know what that great grassroots work is, because I'm not a football person. I'm not a member of any football club. So I want to know, what is that great grassroots, and will that turn into something that will build the League of Ireland into something that it's not currently? Will it mean that we have better underage women's and girls and boys teams winning at under 17, under 19 level? Will it eventually come across and we have a stronger national team? I don't know to what end that grassroots work is happening.
Like the Oireachtas, there's so much stuff like about, you know, executive culture and corporate governance and all this, and yet there's the overriding truth that, you know, that the FAI deals in the single most popular sport in the world in a country that is mad for it, right? Yeah. This should be really easy, right? I mean...
You're calling for the job yourself in your own column today. Like,
I do feel like you put forward your candidacy for CEO in the column today in the Sunday Independent.
Well, I didn't think it was being excessively boastful, right, for me to say that I could have done that job as well as any man has done over the last 100 years, shall we say. I mean, you know, you wouldn't have to be an egomaniac to be thinking that, you know, given what we have in front of us. So, but I think most people think that. This is the odd thing. When anything like this comes up, we get this strange sense that we're looking into a world that is a parallel world, right, in which for some reason people get paid things like 400 grand a year. And we're just baffled by it all, right? We see that story in the front of the Sunday Times about, you know, John Delaney in his UEFA, what is it? 300 allowance a day. And for part of the first paragraph, I'm thinking, well, that's what he gets paid, right? That's quite a lot to get paid, isn't it? No, that's only on top of what he gets paid, right? Yeah, what a world it is, Joe. Where have we gone wrong? I mean, where is this world? Why have I never seen the entrance to it? Yeah. Where is it? I mean, like, all my life I have looked for it, right? and it's there somewhere, right? We see these people who belong to it. Mm. Like, when this is all over, there's a company called Mazars. Yes. They're going to look into it. They look into when corporate governance goes awry, they come in and they look at it for, I would suspect, quite a substantial fee. Something maybe, some of those guys might be on like 400 grand a year and all that. And they'd be thinking that someone like John Delaney is doing it for nothing. You know? I would that I were joking. Would that this was in jest, right? Like, there are many people in the executive world who would genuinely look at John Delaney as almost someone who's doing it pro bono.
He argues himself he could have moved to the private sector and made a whole heap more money.
I have no doubt that there is truth in that. But I would also look at the people he's talking about in the private sector and you know... would they be entirely worth every penny that they're getting? You know, I mean, people ran banks in this country, right? And they were getting unbelievable amounts of amounts of money. The great sort of mystery, I suppose, to all of us, right, is that executive culture in this country has been demonstrated to be in many ways, shall we say, suboptimal. Right, that sometimes the results have not been, as what we might have expected, right, or might have desired, or might have been entitled to expect. And normally, when that happens, there's a great sort of, feeling of retrenchment, and we must review the situation, and we must look at it again. And clearly, that there's a whole culture in which people are being paid far too much money for what they do. Right, none of that has ever happened. This is why it's magical. It's a magical world, Joe, out there. And it, like, there was a line during the week about that in John Delaney, in his new role, the vice president role, he will be getting
executive vice president.
He will be getting substantially less, right? Those words, that's the first time I've ever seen those words used. Those words do not appear in the lexicon of the executive. It's all substantially, there's only substantially more. Mm. You know, there's no less, right? And I mean, how do they do it?
There's still time for you, Declan. You may find a way in.
What about you, Joe? I mean, forget about me for a minute. I mean, like, where have we, you know, like, Sinead, what about
one of the things that they have said that John Delaney is talented, and there's no doubt that he is, and John Green says, like, the local TD or county councillor. So I think a lot of the, and Eamon Dunphy makes the point as well about him going to all these clubs and, you know, making sure that all the clubs get visited by the CEO and get money, that a lot of that is akin to being a politician, like a very successful politician. Very successful politicians do not make €360,000. So I think Joe, when he says that I could have made more in the private sector, a lot of his attributes are not ones that CEOs of the private sector necessarily have. They're more on the political sphere where there is less money, significantly less money to earn.
John Green writes, like, especially in the media, some might find this distasteful, but it's something that can't be ignored because it doesn't fit the Delaney must go narrative. Like a wily old politician, he has steadily built up his support base over the years. He's streetwise and understands his constituents and their needs. He has travelled the country attending functions and all manner of club events, and he's looked after these clubs in any way he could, up to and including financial assistance. And says, like the local TD or county councillor, he might seem out of step with the vast majority, but that is of little consequence to him or his constituents, because he knows how to win votes. You mentioned Eamon Dunphy, people might be interested in that. This is in the main section of the Sunday Independent, page 4. Dunphy speaks out on his heart operation and FAI power game. So, Don Lynch here, you may be wondering where Eamon Dunphy has been over the last while, and you'll have seen he wouldn't have been on the Stand podcast as often as usual, Mick Clifford and Hugh Cahill often filling in. I've had a heart operation, Dunphy tells the Sunday Independent. It's an aneurysm. Been there for 15, 20 years, but they operated on it a few weeks ago. It's serious, not life-threatening. I'm feeling rough and tender. I'm sore. Haven't been able to do my podcasts. So what he's saying about the Delaney situation, grassroots soccer people in this country have come out in support of Delaney. It's extraordinary and very telling. In 13 years, he turned up at over 2,000 events. In addition to that, Irish soccer has a new home. And then he touches on the League of Ireland, because Delaney called it a problem child in the past. And
Dunphy agrees with him.
He says, Niall Quinn. He wants to give the clubs $2 million. That money will disappear like smoke. You might as well burn it. He says, the League of Ireland has been the way it is forever. It's always been a bad joke, delinquent. It's always been on the brink of collapse.
But it doesn't necessarily need to be.
Absolutely like, not. With absolutely that attitude, it will never improve.
Yeah, and like, look at, and I think this is probably one of the most pertinent figures to look at, and hopefully they will look at them on Wednesday. Like, the IRFU have managed in the last 10 years to double their turnover. So they're, like, turning over about 87 million, I think, a year. The FAI is still down at about 50 million. Like, you have to be innovative. The IRFU have to be innovative. They have to create a product. So they are selling a domestic product, but they've done it in a way that, you know, the Celtic League is there. They've managed to, you know, make the Champions Cup something in Ireland that is not the same in other countries as well. We really care about it. They've built a product kind of from the ground up.
They also crucially got their ticket pricing right for the Aviva Stadium.
Yeah, and what Ireland, like what the League of Ireland can do, they have a much more captive audience across a wider geographical spread with a game that both girls and boys love from a much younger age and have much more awareness about. It's an easier game to play, it's an easier game to teach, it's an easier game to follow. Like, there should be no reason that the League of Ireland can't do something quite modest, like, you know, an 80 million turnover, like to get that 50 million to 80 million to create needs something quite modest in terms of turning the League of Ireland into something that better than it is.
That line there, that it's always going to be, you know, it's there's no hope for it almost, is willfully defeatist on Dunphy's part. I'm not sure why he's taken that line. On Richie Sadlier then. So what did Dunphy call him? The Star?
An Egypt.
Yeah. And not a real football person as well, or any kind of serious football person. Dunphy says, he is some kind of football person, but the only one I've seen support the activities the other night. And he said, I think we need to look at RTE's stance here too. If they think it's okay to allow someone to say it's okay for people to throw things on the pitch at the Ibu Stadium, they need to have a look at themselves, says Dunphy. There is a sacred principle in football. It's a principle that goes back to Jimmy Jones, who was a Catholic from the north of Ireland, who was beaten to within an inch of his life by Protestants 60 or so years ago. You don't bring these kinds of protests into the arena. And then he says, and this is a bit of a stretch, I would argue from Jimmy Jones, even a tennis ball, if a player went over it in the wrong way, they could break an ankle.
Yeah, he goes into the absurd there.
Yeah, but Eamon himself was almost unique in his playing career in bringing kind of other issues into football.
Chile, Bloody Sunday, wore the black armband. He is a man who understands the power of protest.
But you see him there. I mean, like, you know, everyone else, apart from the RTE panel where he was for years, seemed to think that his views are interesting and that they're entertaining and that, like, you know, you will go out and seek them out. And yet it just highlights again the absolutely bizarre situation whereby himself and Giles are no longer on the football panel. I mean, it's like, it doesn't make any sense in, you know, I mean, it's obviously ageist, but I mean, you look at, say, the BBC with David Attenborough. Do you know what I mean? They didn't tell him, like, to sort of, that's fine now, David. You know, so it's just, so I'll be here, like, the Sunday Indo have a piece, like, everywhere, anything happens in Irish football, Dunphy, call for Dunphy. What does Dunphy have to say about this? And the only place you won't see him is actually, you know.
Mostly it's because we want to disagree with him as well, though. Yeah. And I really do disagree with him on the protest thing. I think if you're protesting football, you protest it at football. Like,
Eamon Dunphy says. It's like, you know, it's just interesting.
Totally interesting.
To see him saying it. Like, you know, that whatever that thing is that people have who are kind of magnetic personalities or who are good on television or whatever, right? That thing they have whereby it kind of, you just listen to them because they're doing something, they're saying they've got some energy, a certain kind of energy or whatever. He clearly has that. Yeah. And that RTE thinks that it can dispense with that is kind of hilarious, really. You
know? Yeah, I think he's missed, to be honest. Yeah. I never thought I'd say it.
He's doing well with his own thing to stand. It is interesting, though, that a lot of and just my last word on the FAI stuff, because a lot of the players have come out against the protest. You know, Stephen Hunt is writing about it today in the Sindo, and Ronnie Whelan. I think part of the problem is that they see the be-all and end-all as being the senior national team.
Yeah.
So if you see the be-all and end-all as being the senior national team, then of course you're not going to agree with the protest because that's going to get in the way of one match for that senior national team.
Yeah.
But what these football people, as you seemingly have to be to comment on football, is saying that we actually love Irish football and it's bigger than just one match for the national team.
Mm.
So let them protest then. And I think the likes of Stephen Hunt and Eamon Dunphy and the people who profess to be football people in Ireland should acknowledge that in some way, that it's not just about the senior national team playing one match in the Aviva.
Yeah, he's had the accusation thrown at him that somehow he's gotten an association with Delaney, you know. He says, there's no conspiracy of silence amongst the RTE panellists, he insists. You know, I don't think Ronnie Whelan or Damien Duff have anything to do with Delaney. I don't know who set up John Giles Foundation. I think Delaney is interlinked with it, but John has never hidden that. I have never accepted hospitality from Delaney. I know the guy. I haven't spoken to him for years. I've tried to say there's bad stuff, but there's also very good stuff here. We're not looking at some kind of ogre. He has a kind of love for the game, but he has too much power. And he goes on to say, when a committee come for you, you're in trouble. He's in a fight for his life. We'll see how it plays out. Mm. So that's on the Independent main section, page 4.
And meanwhile, in the Sunday Indo, McCarthy fighting for his future. Which seems like a completely bizarre headline. Then you realise it makes complete sense because among the other wonders which the FAI have given us is the fact that this only reminded me Mick McCarthy is going to go after he's only got about
a few games.
Yeah, in a few games. He has
six games left.
He's scheduled
of the normal qualification. Yeah.
So it sets up a great sort of series of possibilities, including that, you know, Mick takes us to the, you know, to the final, at least, of the Euros, and then has to go. Now, the meaning of this headline is that it almost presents the fact that his stint with Ireland is kind of almost his job application for a Premier League team, which I don't see that panning out particularly either, because it's quite evident, looking at it during the week, that Mick is just the perfect manager for the Republic of Ireland for life. He should be simply made manager for life. And going back to something we talked about earlier, good lads, great lads, right? Mick, his whole thing is the goodness of lads, right? He loves good lads, right? And he'll see, he's quoted here saying,
"Joe, you're up. You're a good lad. You're in."
You know, they're good lads. I love coming away for every campaign because you know you're with a great bunch of lads, and they will leave it all out in the pitch. You know, he identifies goodness in lads.
Say he loves good lads again.
But you see, not only that, but he's able to identify goodness in them.
Good right? lads.
Yeah, and that's what that is who he is. Right, and Ireland, the one thing that Irish players, now they're not going to, so they don't have to say the technical proficiency of the Balkan nations, shall
that's
we
true,
say,
yeah.
right? But many of those are not good lads.
No, that's true.
I would suggest some of them are bad lads. I would go so far as to suggest. While they may come on and you know, do a little kind of flourish here and there.
Yeah.
They will not give you what
good
the
lads will
give to Mick McCarthy, which is goodness.
Yeah. I was just looking there to see if he used that term about Glenn Whelan. Philip Quinn is writing about Glenn Whelan in the Mail on Sunday. But he actually doesn't use the good lad term in it, but almost gets there. He said, "I actually thought Glenn had retired, and when I called him and spoke to him, he said, no, haven't. I was retired. So he was always in my thoughts," he explained, just because he's probably a good lad.
Good lad, yeah.
Yeah.
That's on page 86 of the Mail. Above it, by the way, just to give you a broad sense of the coverage, Shane McGrath is writing about John Delaney. He's been the story of Irish soccer for too long, is the headline on that piece. But Shane McGrath does finish that column by saying the connection between the supporters and the team was energising on Tuesday night against Georgia. There is a real sense of optimism about the team suddenly and what Mick McCarthy can do with it.
Yeah, and they play well. But I think also after the protest, what was noticeable, so they did it once, they did it in the 33rd minute, and then once the balls were collected, there was a cheer, and it was very obvious that cheer was for the players.
Yes,
it was like, we are separating these two things. That was it. That's it. We're done. That was the protest over, and now on you get.
That was very apparent in the stadium. I presume it came across to some extent on TV.
It did. I watched it on telly. I wasn't there.
Once all the balls were off, then there was this. A few of the players started raising their hands up to the fans, as if to say, "Right, are we back on board together?"
Yeah.
We are. And the fans responded, and then Conor Hare and Julie obliged, and suddenly the world was good again. Although a few more tennis balls came on for the celebration. Yeah. Is that now a thing for a celebration of goals? I don't know. We'll have to see.
But there was also, of course, the classic scene of George Hamilton and Ronnie Whelan.
Yeah.
It was almost, they had that tone of voice that, you know, when a streaker comes on. You know, sort of, this is this kind of silliness. This,
that I was at the match. I didn't see.
Yeah, they were very annoyed.
You know, when something like that, something unorthodox goes on, and it's like, you know, God, you're going to get that kind of thing. You know,
I know that's wrong. That's like to almost not give it a context.
Yeah, they were really. Yeah, they didn't. They
just a mob threw tennis balls.
Yeah, they didn't give a context in the commentary. And so they went back to the panel, and Damien Duff and Richie Sadlier talked it out. And Richie Sadlier obviously has made headlines.
The half-time,
But in the commentary, you would have not been aware what was happening and what the idea behind it was.
Well, it's not like we're having tennis balls thrown onto the pitch, and this is a problem game after game that needs to be eradicated. This has never happened before. It's obviously a half decent reason. On McCarthy, Seamus Coleman's in all the papers. It seems he was a little bit tetchy.
It's an odd one. Yeah, so it seems that Martin O'Neill has kind of got across to them that we would prefer, myself and Roy Keane would prefer if you just didn't make comments about what went on.
In the previous
regime. And it seems like they've taken it on board. So Paul Rowan is saying, you know, he was really, really reticent to kind of make any comparisons about how the team is playing, which ended up then making it seem like he didn't want to talk about how well they had played during the week.
At one point, Coleman says to a few of the journalists, "I sort of know where you're going with that one."
Yeah.
I don't
want to make comparisons, I think, is what he says.
How can you talk about how the team played, really, without drawing a comparison with how they played previously? And he obviously feels, well, if I say anything, if I even just say we were better, or we were a bit improved, that will be interpreted as a big hit back at O'Neill and Keane, which he doesn't want to do.
It obviously comes from this Matt Doherty thing. So Martin O'Neill picked up the phone to Matt Doherty when he was critical. And so Paul Rowan says, you know, it seems like there's a three-line whip in place with to anything that might be construed as criticism, because Coleman says, I don't want to be answering questions that look like a comparison and be making headlines. And he says that further on again about the tennis balls, about not wanting to make headlines. So maybe it's just in his head at the moment, you know, that and, he and has his own work to do.
Again, Mick, back to Mick, he says, I have got them now and I am not bothered, not one flying flute, what has gone on in the past or what their careers were. It's fair enough.
It is fair enough.
Is there some reason that, can we find out why David McGoldrick, apparently he's called Didsy.
Yeah. I don't know why.
He's a Didsy with an S in the Sunday Independent and Didsy with a Z in the Sunday Times.
I like the way Mick calls Matt Doherty the Doc as well at all times.
Yeah.
It is... I don't know, look, I think Stephen Kenny's going to be a great Ireland manager as well, actually, and I'm glad he got it. But this arrangement is odd.
It's odd,
to say the least.
It's odd knowing who your boss is going to be and that your boss is not going to be your boss for very long.
And, like, you know, like Mick is, you know, he's going to do a good job. I honestly do feel that should be part of the questioning at the Oireachtas on Wednesday. The logic there, because there was the sense of that revolution was in the air around that time. Remember when Keane and O'Neill left, and this seemed like an arrangement
to calm everybody down. It was a sop to everybody because there was two schools of thought.
But it's wrong. Like, I mean, those things just don't work in football. No. For some reason, they seem to make sense, but they don't. For some reason, like, football is such a short-term thing.
Yeah.
That anyone thinking about their five-year plans and all this, like, they're absurd. I mean, Ferguson, actually, above all, used to understand that nothing at all matters other than the next 90 minutes. And then you have to win more or less all your matches forever. You know? And, like, otherwise, it'll be changed. And to be sort of thinking you can have this overview whereby in 18 months' time, then the new man will take over. I mean, no, it's not a kind of a, you know, a car showroom in the home counties of England for everything has run with nice kind of precision and nice smoothness for centuries.
Well, it's kind of why Ole Gunnar Solskjaer had to get the gig now, right? It's working.
Yeah.
You get the gig now and there's no plan B.
You get it until it stops working.
Yeah.
And like Poch with his 5 years, you know, like in 5 years' time, you know, Poch could have done all sorts. But I mean, it literally doesn't work like that. Mm. So,
Like they may well get away with it. It may work out fine. Mick McCarthy may do a good job, but not so spectacular that we can't let him go. And then Stephen Kenny could do a fabulous job. But equally, it could so easily flip around the other way, and then there'll be major questions to be answered.
I did like the idea of having some kind of plan that was also rooted in not just getting failed Premier League managers to come over. So I did like that the fact that there was some thought, but in the end, it did just look like a sop to please both sides of the argument.
Well, Mick is a failed Republic of Ireland manager. I mean, he had that going for him as well. But no, I think he'll be really I think he'll do really well. I think I said he's so perfect. And
for life.
You know, I can see no reason why anyone else would be a better manager ever than Mick McCarthy. You know, things are just meant to be. If ever anything was meant to be, that's meant to be.
And you don't need corporate governance for managerial jobs.
Mick, TC, the Doc, good lads. Do your stuff.
I wonder what he'd think of Dave Myler. Can we just give
Dave Myler's interesting.
Little nod to David Myler. Jim White has a piece in the Sunday Independent. And you knew about this, but I did not know this was a thing.
Yeah, you know, this is well known that David Myler is gifted, like seriously gifted, like world renowned when it comes to FIFA. So he's talking
playing
about that in the Sunday Independent.
Computer game FIFA, not being
working
an executive
FIFA.
At FIFA. But I didn't realise that there was this whole world that you could be a professional FIFA player. So like the kids at home playing whatever they play, whatever consoles they play this on at the moment, don't necessarily dream of becoming the next Messi on an actual pitch. They want to be able to play on their console and they can become world-renowned professional FIFA players, which David Myler is on track to do when he retires. He said he's doing his coaching badges but also might become a professional e-gamer with expertise in FIFA. He sometimes plays as himself if he's playing buddies who aren't as good as him. So they'll go Real Madrid and he'll go Coventry and play as himself and get annoyed with himself if he's not performing well enough in FIFA. He does also say that, you know, he needs to find the balance. Sometimes it was impacting his actual football.
Yeah.
And his manager said, you know, you have to make sure you're hydrating and getting enough sleep.
And his wife
said, I was spending more time with my console than my daughter, so I've made sure I only play when she's not around. Mm. It's a fascinating read. Jim writes from the Telegraph.
Before we scoff here, so this is like a $2 billion industry around the world. The best players in the world make millions. Tournaments do fill arenas.
I'm not scoffing. I'm just amazed.
Yeah. They fill arenas around the world. In 2017, people watched 266 million hours of professional esports just involving one game, Dota 2, on Twitch. So people...
On what? Like, you're not speaking English, Joe.
I know I'm not. But they watched 266 million hours were spent watching other people play these games. There's talk of this going into the Olympics.
Yeah, it's odd as well that for some reason I thought of... remember Craig Johnston played with Liverpool?
Yeah.
Who had this very interesting career after he left Liverpool.
That
he,
the Predator,
he designed
didn't he?
The Predator boot,
yeah.
Right? Because it's actually quite rare for footballers to become very successful at something, you know, like they're so institutionalized, a lot of them, like when they stop football, it's like, what do I do now? Other than like being a pundit or whatever. But to actually kind of create a new industry virtually. I mean, you had examples of people going way back, Dave Whelan,
at Wigan,
yeah. It was very unusual that he actually became very successful outside of football. Yeah. Francis Lee, but they were literally the exceptions that proved the rule.
Yeah,
so few of them would have done that, and so it's interesting to see someone like that who seems to have this potentially enormous career.
This weekend, there's a specially constructed e-gaming arena in West London for the first official e-Premier League competition. So thousands of e-gamers have been battling it out, and they've whittled that down to 40.
Yeah.
So two players representing each of the Premier League's 20 clubs, one playing on Xbox, the other on PlayStation. The winner wearing their team shirt with their name printed across their shoulders, and that's all happening this afternoon.
Yeah.
Myler is disappointed he's not there, but he actually has to go play real football. Can you call that real football? Am I being like discriminatory towards FIFA? I don't know. But he'll be watching the progress of the tournament because the final is being broadcast live on Sky. Now, someone who comes in here and sits down twice a year when we do a sports, women in sports broadcast, and we talk about how you have to get people to come to things before they'll broadcast them live on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Sorry, lads. Now, you're broadcasting a load of grown adults playing PlayStation on the telly now.
To a packed arena.
Mm. Like,
David Myler alone has 350 subscribers on YouTube. This guy is a cottage.
350,000.
Sorry, 350,000.
Yeah. I have 350 subscribers.
350,000 subscribers.
My million.
He was saying as well, it's quite funny. Remember Aidan McGeady's brilliant goal in, it was Tbilisi, remember the little pirouette and the shot? Yeah, yeah. So FIFA, one of the moves you can do in the game is the McGeady spin, you know?
And that's it, is it?
That is why it's named after Aidan McGeady. So Myler is disgusted with this because he says, I actually played in that game when he did that. And now I can do it on screen when I'm playing FIFA. And this is the thing. He says, every football ground McGeady goes to, he gets mobbed by kids telling them they can do the McGeady spin on FIFA and asking for selfies. And what really cheeses me off is he doesn't, he's getting all that fame, he doesn't even play FIFA. So,
and what we're looking at here ultimately is the end of football.
Yeah,
oh, it's the end
that's
of
what I was
humanity,
like,
really.
What? So these kids now are idolising David Myler because he can do a spin that Andy McGeady can do in real life, but he can do it on FIFA, so the kids want his autograph and selfie because they can also do it on FIFA, but not in real life.
Look, this is the future.
Maybe we need the Oireachtas Committee to ask John Delaney questions about this.
In three or four Olympic cycles, we're all going to be into the e-gaming department. Honestly, even Declan Lynch, you'll be writing about your enjoyment of the e-gaming.
I'm sure, look, I've no doubt about
I
that.
I love a good niche Olympic sport.
Yeah. Well, this is right up your street, yeah. So this is
we
coming.
Will see. I will not rule it out.
So that's David Myler. Anything else as we begin to wrap this up? You noticed Raheem Sterling is getting nothing but love in the papers now.
Yeah, it's quite the turnaround. We have Rod Little saying that he is world class and the best player that England have right now. England's best player on Monday alongside the reborn Ross Barkley was Raheem Sterling, the most naturally gifted forward we have had in a generation or two and unquestionably deserving of the term world class. He is still, to my mind, a little underappreciated and certainly was so in the World Cup. I think a lot of people would agree that he was taken off too early in the semi-final. He kind of takes a different approach to what he has done off the field, calling some newspapers out for being racist in their coverage of him. But David Walsh actually says that Raheem Sterling was completely correct to do that. And, you know, the Mail sport chief sport writer editor has come out and said, you know, they'll try and do better in the future. So he is on and off the field kind of convinced him that he is more mature and one to watch. But it's isn't that crazy that Sterling this time last year was absolutely the opposite of the darling of media. Now you have two columns in the Sunday Times.
Well, it's kind of Raheem is like his textbook racism, right? You've got this herd mentality as well now that, like, you know, people have suddenly discovered that he's a wonderful footballer, and that's great. He was always a wonderful footballer. Like, I mean, those are Liverpool fans. Like, you could see, like, after 2 minutes, like, Raheem Sterling is a first class footballer. He's a high, you know, he's a class player, right? And this was always obvious, right? His only problem was that he was black. And as a result, all the kind of, things that young professional footballers do were, you know, because he was black, he was cast in entirely racist terms, you know, as this is an example. I mean, if you put them all in front of you, like, it would just be like a seminar on racism in the media. And it's like they've suddenly finally copped onto this and have now all run in the other direction. And it's now Raheem Sterling, surely a candidate for the next Secretary Generalship of the United Nations, if not, in fact, Prime Minister. You know, so there's almost something comical in the reaction all at the same time they've now realised this. It's interesting on many levels. First of all, in terms of the media and the way they all say the same thing until somebody says something different, and then they all say the same different thing, right? And just how prevalent something like, or how endemic racism is, that, you know, such an obvious case of it should have been promulgated for so long and to such an extent. Remarkable, really.
Well, it took him saying it.
It took himself calling it out and not really being listened to for what, a good couple of years before.
There was the Instagram post in the last, 6 months?
Yeah.
Which really sparked off a debate where he compared the stories.
So, like, one was a black footballer who bought the house for his mother, the other was a white footballer. The white footballer was praised for
securing his future,
for the generosity, and the black footballer was ridiculed for the greed. And
hasn't even played a Premier League game, all this kind of stuff splashes out. They called it a mansion as opposed to a house.
It was very well. It's sort of relevant in terms of the Brexit stuff and everything, just the kind of resentment of the England football team having basically that his best player was black. It's surprising just how large the amount of people are who really aren't comfortable with that still. And yet, you know, one of the great triumphs of modern Britain has been how well, you know, how racial integration has worked, to the extent that you do have this normal situation now where, you know, most of the England first team are not sort of white as such, right? And nobody notices it apart from these, you know, wackos, right? Who unfortunately seem to control the Conservative Party at the moment. But there's a constituency which they speak to and which, you know, some newspapers represent. And that is, you know, far out of proportion to what it should be, but it's still very potent.
Yeah,
you know, and it's just, I said, like, it's just textbook stuff. You know, I mean, Raheem will be. I just regret the fact that Kloppo came in about a year too late.
Imagine if he'd,
you know,
because I actually, I know you're saying it was obvious from moment. The very first moment that Raheem Sterling was going to be first class, I really wasn't sure about him long term. I thought he was unbelievably gifted, like pace and could dribble, but I thought there really was a genuine end product problem. And he didn't strike the ball really well enough for me as well. Well, but he's improved massively, and he's still so young.
I feel a bit foolish
for not actually.
But I think you probably were, even with all best intentions, you probably are a little bit influenced by hearing all the time that someone is immature. You know, if you're hearing all the time, it was nothing.
I'm just watching the game. I didn't know anything about his life really off the field at all. I hadn't seen the reports. I actually genuinely just thought, I just wasn't sure about him as being world class delivering at the top stage. I think Guardiola's just been unbelievable for him and turned him into just this amazing player.
No, I think he always had. There was a match against City. It was around Christmas when I think it was his first real season in the team. And he, like any young player, he'd been kind of okay and then not good. But there was a match against City at City and he just looked really good. Mm. It's like he had come into his own, and he just did a few things that were so obviously, you know, first class. And
but he had it.
Yeah. You know, I mean, just the way he carried himself, the way, just the, whatever class players do, you know, and he was still so young, and yet, you know, in that game, he did a couple of things which were just outstanding and which he had no right to be able to do, and which you just don't see most players doing. So from that moment, almost, you knew he was, and whatever problems with finishing or whatever, he would
sort them out. See, I wasn't sure. I think I have a bias against tricky wingers who rely on their pace through the youth ranks. Like Theo Walcott never got to grips with the game, never got the game intelligence. You still wouldn't back Theo Walcott in a one-on-one to finish if your life depended on it. You know, you'd be edgy as he was closing in on goal. And I just thought, I wonder, has Sterling relied on pace too much growing up and jinking past players?
And hasn't learned the other things, like Jacob Stockdale again, how to dive, how to bend down. It's been too easy for you.
But like, ironically, Guardiola, who's, you know, this artist, has actually got those nuts and bolts things, those nuts and bolts aspects of Sterling's game, and really fashioned them into something so consistently brilliant that he delivers consistently. So
and he also scored great goals for Liverpool, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't that he wasn't scoring goals. He did, you know. I mean,
I didn't think he was rubbish, by the way. Just like, let's not go overboard here. I'm not saying, God, he's useless. I would just say
you had concerns.
He surprised me. I didn't think this is England's best player for a decade potentially. I didn't think he was quite at that level.
Well, he was just one of those players, you know, who I think Rafa actually bought him, didn't he? As a child from QPR, you know. So he obviously was one of those players who had such potential that people were prepared to pay £1 million for him when he was like 14.
Didn't his mum make him go to QPR rather than what big club was looking for him? Arsenal, I think.
Not sure.
Yeah, I think that's his story behind. So he's obviously had some people minding him on the way up as well.
Yeah, well, good on him. We're pretty much out of time. Just to mention, by the way, David Snaid's done an interview with Ray Houghton. Anniversary of Hillsborough is approaching. Ray had an interest, and he was saying he will still get flashbacks to the day, especially when he's going to games, like the Liverpool-Bayern Munich one recently, really kind of stuck Hillsborough in his mind. It's worth a read there on page 84 of the Mail on Sunday. Anything else you want to direct people towards?
Not one in the papers, but people will have heard this morning that Ailish Considine from Clare won the grand final of the AFLW, so Aussie Rules, women's Aussie Rules down in Australia, playing with the Crows. So the 42 had a feature with her mother and one of her former coaches yesterday, which is well worth the read. The mother obviously didn't want to make the journey to visit her, but Ailish had been trying to get her to come out, and she had said, well, if you make the final and you're playing, I'll come out. Both things looked a bit rocky earlier on in the year. She was dropped on in game 6, but obviously got back and she scored a goal in the grand final overnight. So it's worth the read to kind of get to know her and get to know what's happening with her career.
Declan, anything you want to?
One final comment on Raheem Sterling is that he's a good lad as well,
which is the most important thing in life, really.
It's the only thing.
Okay, thanks both of you for coming in. Declan Lynch of the Sunday Independent and Sinead O'Carroll from the Journal. We are taking a short break. Back in a moment.